Chapter 76. Louis XVII. The tremendous cannonading, however, had a singular effect upon the inhabitants of the great public hospital of Charenton, in which it may be remembered Louis XVII had been, as in mockery, confined. His majesty of demeanor, his calm deportment, the reasonableness of his pretensions, had not failed to strike with awe and respect his 4,000 comrades of captivity. The Emperor of China, the Princess of the Moon, Julius Caesar, Saint Genevieve, the patron saint of Paris, the Pope of Rome, the Cacique of Mexico, and several singular and illustrious personages who happened to be confined there, all held a council with Louis XVII, semicolon, and all agreed that now or never was the time to support his legitimate pretensions to the crown of France. As the cannons roared around them, they howled with furious delight in response. They took counsel together. Dr. Pinel and the infamous jailers, who, under the name of keepers, held them in horrible captivity, were pounced upon and overcome in a twinkling. The strait waistcoats were taken off from the wretched captives languishing in the dungeons. The guardians were invested in these shameful garments, and with triumphant laughter plunged under the douches. The gates of the prison were flung open, and they marched forth in the blackness of the storm. On the third day, the cannonading was observed to decrease. Only a gun went off fitfully now and then. On the fourth day, the Parisians said to one another, "Teens, ils sont fatigues, les cannoniers des forts." And why? Because there was no more powder? Eh, truly, there was no more powder. There was no more powder, no more guns, no more gunners, no more forts, no more nothing. The forts had blown each other up. The battle roar ceased. The battle clouds rolled off. The silver moon, the twinkling stars, looked blandly down from the serene azure, and all was peace stillness, the stillness of death. Holy, holy silence. Yes. The Battle of Paris was over. And where were the combatants? All gone, not one left. And where was Louis Philippe? The venerable prince was a captive in the Tuileries. The Irish brigade was encamped around it. They had reached the palace a little too late. It was already occupied by the partisans of His Majesty Louis XVII. That respectable monarch and his followers better knew the way to the Tuileries than the ignorant sons of Aaron. They burst through the feeble barriers of the guards. They rushed triumphant into the kingly halls of the palace. They seated the 17th Louis on the throne of his ancestors. And the Parisians read in the Journal des Debats of the 5th of November an important article which proclaimed that the civil war was concluded. The troubles which distracted the greatest empire in the world are at an end. Europe, which marked with sorrow the disturbances which agitated the bosom of the Queen of Nations, the great leader of civilization, may now rest in peace. That monarch whom we have long been sighing for, whose image has lain hidden, and yet oh, how passionately worshipped, in every French heart, is with us once more. Blessings be on him, blessings, a thousand blessings upon the happy country which is at length restored to his beneficent, his legitimate, his reasonable sway. His most Christian Majesty Louis XVII, yesterday arrived at his palace of the Tuileries, accompanied by his august allies. His Royal Highness the Duke of Orleans has resigned his post as Lieutenant General of the Kingdom, and will return speedily to take up his abode at the Palace Royal. It is a great mercy that the children of His Royal Highness, who happened to be in the late forts round Paris, before the bombardment which has so happily ended in their destruction, had returned to their father before the commencement of the cannonading. They will continue, as heretofore, to be the most loyal supporters of order and the throne. None can read without tears in their eyes our august monarch's proclamation. Louis, by Annecy, my children. After 999 years of captivity, I am restored to you. The cycle of events predicted by the ancient Magi, and the planetary convolutions mentioned in the lost Sibylline books, have fulfilled their respective idiosyncrasies, and ended as always in the depths of my dungeons I confidently expected, in the triumph of the good angel, and the utter discomfiture of the abominable blue dragon. When the bombarding began, and the powers of darkness commenced their hellish gunpowder evolutions, I was close by in my palace of Charenton, 333,000 miles off, in the ring of Saturn I witnessed your misery. My heart was affected by it, and I said, is the multiplication table a fiction? Are the signs of the zodiac mere astronomer's prattle? I clapped chains, shrieking and darkness, on my physician, Dr. Pinnell. The keepers I shall cause to be roasted alive. I summoned my allies round about me. The high contracting powers came to my bidding. Monarchs from all parts of the earth. Sovereigns from the moon and other illumined orbits. The white necromancers, and the pale imprisoned genia. I whispered the mystic sign, and the doors flew open. We entered Paris in triumph, by the Charenton Bridge. Our luggage was not examined at the octroi. The bottle green ones were scared at our shouts, and retreated, howling. They knew us, and trembled. My faithful peers and deputies will rally around me. I have a friend in Turkey, the Grand Vizier of the Muslims. He was a Protestant once, Lord Brougham by name. I have sent to him to legislate for us. He is wise in the law, and astrology, and all sciences. He shall aid my ministers in their councils. I have written to him by the post. There shall be no more infamous madhouses in France, where poor souls shiver in strait waistcoats. I recognized Louis Philippe, my good cousin. He was in his counting house, counting out his money, as the old prophecy warned me. He gave me up the keys of his gold. I shall know well how to use it. Taught by adversity, I am not a spendthrift, neither am I a miser. I will endow the land with noble institutions instead of diabolical forts. I will have no more cannon founded. They are a curse, and shall be melted the iron ones into railroads, the bronze ones into statues of beautiful saints, angels, and wise men, the copper ones into money, to be distributed among my poor. I was poor once, and I love them. There shall be no more poverty, no more wars, no more avarice, no more passports, no more custom houses, no more lying, no more physic. My chambers will put the seal to these reforms. I will it. I am the king. Signed, Louis. Apostrophe, some alarm was created yesterday by the arrival of a body of the English foot guard under the Duke of Jenkins. They were at first about to sack the city, but on hearing that the banner of the lilies was once more raised in France, the Duke hastened to the Tuileries and offered his allegiance to His Majesty. It was accepted. And the plush guard has been established in place of the Swiss, who waited on former sovereigns. The Irish brigade quartered in the Tuileries are to enter our service. Their commander states that they took every one of the forts round Paris, and having blown them up, were proceeding to release Louis XVII. When they found that august monarch, happily, free, news of their glorious victory has been conveyed to Dublin, to His Majesty the King of the Irish. It will be a new laurel, to add to his green crown. And thus have we brought to a conclusion our history of the great French Revolution of 1884. It records the actions of great and various characters, the deeds of various valor, it narrates wonderful reverses of fortune, it affords the moralist scope for his philosophy, perhaps it gives amusement to the merely idle reader. Nor must the latter imagine, because there is not a precise moral affixed to the story, that its tendency is otherwise than good. He is a poor reader, for whom his author is obliged to supply a moral application. It is well in spelling books and for children. It is needless for the reflecting spirit. The drama of Punch himself is not moral. But that drama has had audiences all over the world. Happy he, who in our dark times can cause a smile. Let us laugh then, and gladden in the sunshine, though it be but as the ray upon the pool, that flickers only over the cold black depths below. Cox's Diary. The Announcement. On the 1st of January, 1838, I was the master of a lovely shop in the neighborhood of Oxford Market, of a wife, Mrs. Cox, of a business, both in the shaving and cutting line, established 33 years, of a girl and boy respectively of the ages of 18 and 13, of a three-windowed front, both to my first and second pair, of a young foreman, my present partner, Mr. Orlando Crump, and of that celebrated mixture for the human hair, invented by my late uncle, and called Cox's Bohemian Balsam of Tokay, sold in pots at 2 and 3 and 3 and 9. The balsam, the lodgings, and the old established cutting and shaving business brought me in a pretty genteel income. I had my girl, Jemimrin, at Hackney, to school, my dear boy, Tuggeridge, plaited her hair beautifully. My wife at the counter behind the tray of patent soaps, and she cut as handsome a figure as possible, and it was my hope that Orlando and my girl, who were mighty soft upon one another, would one day be joined together in hyming, and, conjointly with my son Tug, carry on the business of hairdressers, when their father was either dead or a gentleman. For a gentleman me, and Mrs. C. determined I should be. Jemima was, you see, a lady herself, and of very high connections. Though her own family had met with crosses, and was rather low, Mr. Tuggeridge, her father, kept the famous tripe shop near the Pigtail and Sparrow, in the Whitechapel Road, from which place I married her, being myself very fond of the article, and especially when she served it to me, the dear thing. Jemima's father was not successful in business. And I married her, I am proud to confess it, without a shilling. I had my hands, my house, and my Bohemian balsam to support her. And we had hopes from her uncle, a mighty rich East India merchant, who, having left this country 60 years ago as a cabin boy, had arrived to be the head of a great house in India, and was worth millions, we were told. 3 years after Jemimrin's birth and 2 after the death of my lamented father-in-law, Tuggeridge, head of the great house of Budgerow and Company, retired from the management of it, handed over his shares to his son, Mr. John Tuggeridge, and came to live in England, at Portland Place and Tuggeridgeville, Surrey, and enjoy himself. Soon after, my wife took her daughter in her hand and went, as in duty bound, to visit her uncle. But whether it was that he was proud and surly, or she somewhat sharp in her way, the dear girl fears nobody, let me have you to know. A desperate quarrel took place between them, and from that day to the day of his death, he never set eyes on her. All that he would condescend to do, was to take a few dozen of lavender water from us in the course of the year, and to send his servants to be cut and shaved by us. All the neighbors laughed at this poor ending of our expectations, for Jemmy had bragged not a little. However, we did not care, for the connection was always a good one, and we served Mr. Hawk, the valet, Mr. Barr, the coachman, and Mrs. Breedbiscuit, the housekeeper, willingly enough. I used to powder the footman too, on great days, but never in my life saw old Tuggeridge, except once, when he said, "Oh, the barber," tossed up his nose, and passed on. One day, one famous day last January, all our market was thrown into a high state of excitement by the appearance of no less than 3 vehicles at our establishment. As me, Jemmy, my daughter, Tug, and Orlando, were sitting in the back parlor over our dinner, it being Christmas time, Mr. Crump had treated the ladies to a bottle of port, and was longing that there should be a mistletoe bow. At which proposal my little Jemimrin looked as red as a glass of negus, we had just, I say, finished the port, when, all of a sudden, Tug bellows out, "La, Pa, here's Uncle Tuggeridge's housekeeper in a cab." And Mrs. Breedbiscuit it was, sure enough Mrs. Breedbiscuit in deep mourning, who made her way, bowing, and looking very sad, into the back shop. My wife, who respected Mrs. B. more than anything else in the world, set her a chair, offered her a glass of wine, and vowed it was very kind of her to come. A. Ma'am, says Mrs. B., I'm sure I'd do anything to serve your family, for the sake of that poor dear Tuck-Tuck-Tuck-Guggeruch, that's gone. That's what? Cries my wife. What, gone? Cried Jim Imran, bursting out crying as little girls will about anything or nothing, and Orlando looking very rueful, and ready to cry too. Yes, gaw, just as she was at this very odd, Tug roars out, La, Pa. Here's Mr. Barr, Uncle Tug's coachman. It was Mr. Barr. When she saw him, Mrs. Breedbiscuit stepped suddenly back into the parlor with my ladies. That is it, Mr. Barr? Says I, and as quick as thought, I had the towel under his chin, Mr. Barr in the chair, and the whole of his face in a beautiful foam of lather. Mr. Barr made some resistance. Aunt, think of it, Mr. Cox, says he. Don't trouble yourself, sir. But I lathered away and never minded. And what's this melancholy event, sir, says I, that has spread desolation in your family's bosoms? I can feel for your loss, sir, I can feel for your loss. I said so out of politeness, because I served the family, not because Tuggeridge was my uncle, no, as such I disown him. Mr. Barr was just about to speak. S, sir, says he, my master's gone when at the iron walks Mr. Hawk, the own man. The finest gentleman I ever saw. What, you here, Mr. Barr? Says he. Yes, I am, sir, and haven't I a right, sir? A mighty wet day, sir, says I to Mr. Hawk, stepping up and making my bow. Sad circumstance too, sir. And is it a turn of the tongs that you want today, sir? Oh, there, Mr. Crump. Turn, Mr. Crump, if you please, sir, said Mr. Hawk, making a bow. But from you, sir, never, no, never, split me. And I wonder how some fellows can have the insolence to allow their masters to shave them. With this, Mr. Hawk flung himself down to be curled. Mr. Barr suddenly opened his mouth in order to reply, but seeing there was a tiff between the gentlemen, and wanting to prevent a quarrel, I rammed the advertiser into Mr. Hawk's hands, and just popped my shaving brush into Mr. Barr's mouth, a capital way to stop angry answers. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.